Chapter 16. Stars swam in the glass of the crystal pyramid, faint shimmers of light that winked from the past, the light already thousands or even millions of years old. To be able to look into the past so clearly had always fascinated Ahriman, the notion that what you were seeing in the present was an echo of the past. The air within the Fotep sanctum was cool, a precisely modulated climate that owed nothing to machine control. The floor was a spiral of black and white crystal, each piece hand-picked from the reflecting caves beneath Tiska and shaped by Magnus's own hand. Starlight glinted on the reflective chips and gleamed from the silver threads and blood-drop pendants hanging from Magnus's feathered cloak. The Primarch stood immobile as a statue beneath the apex of the pyramid, his arms folded across his chest and his head tilted back to allow him to look out into the immensity of space. When Magnus descended to the surface of a world, his pavilion was a recreation of this inner sanctum, but it could never hope to capture the rarefied atmosphere that filled this place. "Welcome, Ahriman," said Magnus, without averting his gaze from the stars. "You are just in time to watch Mechanicum Borealis with me. Come, join me in the centre." Ahriman walked the spiral, following the black chips towards the centre, letting the walk cleanse him of his negative thoughts in readiness for his walk out along the white spiral. He studied Magnus as he walked. Ever since the conclusion of the great triumph, the Primarch had been withdrawn and sullen. Hastur Sejanus had been right about the nature of the Emperor's announcement. It had radically changed the universe in which they operated. For close to 200 years, the Emperor, beloved by all, had led the Great Crusade from the front, fighting in the vanguard of humanity's second expansion to the edges of the galaxy. Those days were over, for the Emperor had announced his withdrawal from the fighting, telling his faithful warriors that the time had come for him to relinquish control of the crusade to another. The Astartes had wept to hear that their beloved master was leaving them, but as epochal as this separation was, it was more than matched by the Emperor's next pronouncement. Before the gathered warriors, the Emperor removed the golden laurels that had been his most iconic accoutrement and bestowed them upon his brightest son. No longer would the Emperor command the armies of the Imperium. That honour now fell to Horus Lupercal, the War Master. It was an old title, revived from dusty antiquity, yet it was a natural fit and perfectly encapsulated the unique qualities of the Lunar Wolves Primarch. From the millions of warriors gathered before the steel-sheen dais, adulation had mixed with sorrow, but Ahriman had felt the conflicting waves of powerful emotions as the other Primarchs reacted to Horus's ascension. Perhaps they felt it should have been them, or perhaps they raged at having to take orders from one of their own. Either way, it made little difference. The decision had been made, and the Emperor was unequivocal in its necessity. Many warriors had expected to renew old acquaintances or swear new bonds of brotherhood on Ulanor, but with the Emperor's pronouncements made, the gathering of Astartes broke up with almost unseemly haste. The 28th expedition had left Ulanor and made the 2-month journey to Hexium Minora, a Mechanicum outpost world, to resupply. The bulk of the Thousand Suns had borne witness to the beginnings of the Galactic New Order, while some had been on detached duties elsewhere in the sector. With each passing day, more of Magnus's sons joined their parent legion to await tasking orders from the Crusade's new master. Sotekis led a mentor company back from supporting the World Eaters in the Golgothan Deeps, and word came through that the last battle formation to arrive, Kenafia's Thunderbringers, had returned after fighting alongside the 4th Legion of Perturabo. There were still elements of the Legion scattered throughout the galaxy, but the majority had found its way to Hexium Minora. For 6 months, the Thousand Suns fleet suckled at the planet's forges and materiel silos like newborns eager for the teat. Billions of rounds of ammunition, thousands of tons of food and water, uniforms, dried goods, pioneer supplies, armoured vehicles, power cells, fuel bladders, and the myriad items an expeditionary fleet required in order to function were shipped from the surface in bulk lifters or via impossibly slender Tsiolkovsky towers. With resupply almost complete, the Legion and its millions of supporting soldiers lay at anchor, awaiting orders. The months had not been wasted. Army units conducted battle drills alongside the Astartes. both forces learning much of the other's abilities and limitations. Each captain of fellowship divided his time between battle training and exercises of mental discipline to refresh his powers and his connection to the ether, but the Legion was eager to be in the thick of things again. Nor were the remembrances idle. Most spent their time honing prose for post-Crusade publication, all the while hoping to learn more of the glorious triumph at Ulanor. Others rendered sketches taken over the course of the conquest of Heliosa or during its transitional period en route to compliance, while the lucky few chosen as neophytes by the Thousand Sons continued their training. "It's beautiful, is it not?" asked Magnus, as Araman joined him. "It is, my lord," agreed Araman. "I can see so much when I look out from this sanctum, Azek, but there is so much more that can be learned. I know much, it is true, but I will know everything one day." Magnus smiled and shook his head, as though amused at his own conceit. "No need to hide your frown, my friend," he said. "I am not so arrogant as to have forgotten my studies of the plays of Aristophanes and the dialogues of Plato. To know is to know that you know nothing. That is the meaning of true knowledge." "I do not look so deeply into the heavens, my lord," said Araman, "but looking at the stars always gives me a sense of peace, knowing that there is an order to the galaxy. It gives me stability in times of change."
"You say that as though change is to be feared," said Magnus, at last looking down at him.
"Change is sometimes necessary," said Araman, with a disarming smile, "but I prefer order. It is more predictable."
Magnus chuckled. "Yes, I can see how that would be pleasant, Azek. But the perfect ordered world is dead and stagnant. The real world is alive because it is full of change, disorder, and decay. The old order must pass away so the new one may arise."
"Is that what happened on Ulanor?" ventured Araman.
"In a manner of speaking. No order, not even a God-given one, will last forever. After all, the grand principle of creation is that nothing and possibility come in and out of bond infinite times in a finite moment."
Araman kept silent and showed us to the Primarch's exact meaning. Magnus folded his arms and sighed and said,
"We are alone in the stars, Azek."
"My lord?"
"The Emperor leaving the Crusade," said Magnus. "I heard him speak to Horus upon the reviewing stand. My brother desired to know why our father was leaving us. And you know what he said?"
"No, my lord," said Araman, though he understood the question was rhetorical.
"He said that it was not because he wearied of the fighting, but because a greater destiny called him. One, he claimed, would ensure the legacy of our conquests will live on until the ending of the stars. Of course, Horus wanted to know what that was, but our father did not tell him, which I saw cut him deeply. You see, Horus was the first of us to be reunited with our father after our scattering. He fought at his side for nearly 30 years, father and only son. Such a bond is unique and not easily relinquished. Truth be told, it is a bond many of my brothers look upon with no small amount of jealousy."
"But not you?"
"Me? No. I never lost contact with my father. We spoke many times before he ever set foot on Prospero. That is a bond that none of my brothers can claim. As our legion departed Ulanor, I communed with my father and told him what I found on Agoru, a hidden labyrinth of tunnels that pierce the immaterium and link all places in all times."
Magnus returned his eye to the stars, and Araman kept silent, sensing that to intrude on Magnus's introspection would be unwise, though the ramifications of his discoveries on Agoru were staggering.
"Do you know what he said, Azek? Do you know how he greeted this momentous discovery, this key to every corner of the galaxy?"
"No, my lord."
"He knew," said Magnus simply. "He already knew of it. I should not have been surprised, I suppose. If any being in the galaxy could know such a thing, it would be my father. Now that he knew I had also discovered this lattice, he told me he had discovered it decades ago and had resolved to become its master. This is why he returns to Terra."
"That is great news, surely?"
"Absolutely," said Magnus, without enthusiasm. "I immediately volunteered my services, of course, but my offer of assistance was declined."
"Declined? Why?"
Magnus's shoulders dropped a fraction as he said, "Apparently, my father's researches are at too delicate a stage to allow another soul to look upon them."
"That surprises me," said Ahriman. "After all, there is no greater student of the esoteric than Magnus the Red. Did the Emperor say why he declined your help?"
"He not only declines my assistance, he warns me to delve no further into my studies. He assures me that he has a vital role for me in the final realization of his grand designs, but he would tell me no more."
"Did you ask what Lehman Russ had told him?"
Magnus shook his head. "No," he said. "My father knows my lupine brother's ways well enough. He does not need me to point out how ridiculous and hypocritical they are."
"Still," said Ahriman, "it is a shame to have lost the opportunity to learn more of the wolves. Othair Weirdmake and I formed a close bond. With Uthazar's help, I would have learned much more of the inner workings of the Wolf King's Legion."
Magnus nodded and smiled. "Have no fear, Azek," he said. "Weirdmake was not our only source within the wolves. I have other assets in place, none of whom know they dance to my tune."
Ahriman waited for Magnus to continue, but the Primarch kept his own counsel. Before he could ask any more, the star shimmered, as though a layer of gauze had been drawn over the crystal pyramid.
"Look," said Magnus, "the Mechanicum Borealis. It begins."
Like a painting left out in the rain, the image of the stars smeared in the blackness, a fusion of chemical overspill and atmospheric vapor fires on Hexium Minora, caught the arcing light of the system's distant star, refracting a shimmering halo around the world as though it were ablaze from pole to pole with rainbow fires. The effect was wondrous. Despite being born of chronic pollution and rampant industry, pursued without heed of the cost to the planet's ecology. To Ahriman, it was proof that something wonderful could come from the most ugly of sources. A side effect of the Mechanicum Borealis was the thinning of the veil between the material world and the immaterium, and a melange of unnameable colours and etheric tempests swirled around the planet's corona, a distant seascape viewed through a glass darkly.
"The great ocean," said Magnus, his voice full of longing. "How beautiful it is."
Ahriman kept the lights in his private library low, claiming that any aid to concentration was of paramount importance. Lemuel had been surprised how small his mentor's sanctum was, a chamber no larger than that of a Terran bureaucrat. For a room described as a library, there were precious few books to be found, merely a single bookcase filled with leather scroll tubes and loosely bound sheaves of paper. A large wooden desk of a pale, polished and darkly veined wood with an inset blotter of green leather stood against one wall, and a number of thick books with spines a half metre or more in length lay opened across its length. An armour stand bore Ahriman's battle plate, like a silent observer of his failures. It reminded Lemuel of Colophus's robots, and the thought of those soulless, mechanised warriors sent a shiver down Lemuel's spine.
"Can you see it yet?" asked Ahriman.
"No."
"Look again. Drift with the currents. Remember all I have taught you since Shrike."
"I'm trying, but there are so many. How can I tell what's the actual future and what's a potential future?"
"That," said Ahriman, "is where the skill of the individual diviner comes into play. Some prognosticators have an innate connection to the etheric paths that guide them with unerring accuracy to the truth, while others must sift through a thousand images of meaningless symbolism to reach it."
"Which are you?"
asked Lemuel, without opening his eyes and trying to visualize the myriad paths of the falling cards. "Think less about me, more about the cards," warned Ahriman. "Ready?"
"Ready."
A precisely stacked house of cards sat on the lip of the desk, arranged in a delicately balanced pyramid. Ahriman had produced them from a battered, cloth-wrapped tin, 78 cards of what he called a Visconti Sforza Trionfi deck. Each card was exquisitely detailed and lovingly rendered with vivid colours and expressively wrought images of regal men and women. "Catch the Seven of Denari," said Ahriman, and slammed an open palm down on the desk. The pyramid of cards collapsed, each one fluttering to the floor in a crazed whirlwind of spinning horsemen, kings and princesses. Lemuel snatched his hand out, seizing a card and holding it up before him. "Show me," said Ahriman. Lemuel flipped a card, which showed a female figure reaching up to touch an 8-rayed star. "The star," said Ahriman. "Try again." "It's impossible," said Lemuel in resignation. He had been trying to catch whichever card Ahriman named from the falling stack for the last 3 hours without success. "I can't do it."
"You can. Lift your mind into the lower enumerations to clear it of the clutter of material concerns. Let your mind float free of hunger, want, and desire. Only then can you follow the correct path to the future echoes."
"Free my mind from desire? That's hard for me to do," pointed out Lemuel.
"I never promised this would be easy. Quite the contrary, in fact."
"I know, but it's not easy for a man of my appetites to suppress them," said Lemuel, patting his ample but shrinking gut.
Shipboard cuisine was a bland mixture of reconstituted pastes and flash-frozen organics grown in ventral hydroponic bays. It nourished the body, but did little else.
"Then the enumerations will help you," said Ahriman. "Rise into the low spheres and visualize the paths each card will take, the interactions as they strike one another, the ripples they cause in the system. Learn to read the geometric progressions of potentiality as each permutation gives birth to 1,000 more outcomes, regardless of how similar the beginning parameters were. In the Forgotten Ages, some people knew this as chaos theory, others as fractal geometry."
"I can't do it," protested Lemuel. "Your brain was crafted for that sort of thing, but mine wasn't."
"It is not my enhanced cognition that allows me to see the cards fall. I am not a mathematical savant."
"Then you do it," challenged Lemuel.
"Very well," said Ahriman, rebuilding the house of cards with calm dexterity. When the pyramid was complete, he turned to Lemuel. "Name a card." Lemuel thought for a moment.
"The chariot,"
he said at last.
Ahriman nodded and closed his eyes, standing before the desk with his hands at his sides.
"Ready?" asked Lemuel.
"Yes." Lemuel banged the table, and the cards fell to the floor. Ahriman's hand darted out like a striking snake and snatched a single gilt-edged card from the air. He turned it over to reveal a golden chariot drawn by 2-winged white horses. He placed the card face up on the desk. "You see, it can be done."
"Astartes reflexes," said Lemuel.
Ahriman smiled and said, "Is that what you think?" "Very well. Shall we try once more?" Once again, Ahriman built the house of cards and asked Lemuel to name a card. Lemuel did so, and Ahriman closed his eyes, standing before the precariously balanced cards. Instead of keeping his arms at his sides, he extended a hand with his thumb and forefinger outstretched, holding his fingertips close together, as though gripping an invisible card. His breathing deepened, and his eyes darted back and forth behind their lids. "Do it," said Ahriman. Lemuel thumped the desk, and the cards collapsed in a rain of images. Ahriman didn't move, and a single card fluttered through the air to slide precisely between his fingertips. Lemuel was not the least bit surprised when the librarian flipped it over to reveal a divine figure bearing a fiery sword in his right hand and an eagle-topped globe in his left hand. Angels flew above the figure, blowing golden trumpets from which hung silk banners. "Just as you wanted," said Ahriman. "Judgment." 4 days later, Lemuel was once again ensconced within Ahriman's library, though this time he had been promised remembrances instead of instruction. Almost a year after being denied the opportunity to descend to the surface of Ulanor, Lemuel had hoped for a first-hand account of Horus Lupercal's ascension to Warmaster. In this, he was to be disappointed. When Lemuel asked about the great triumph, Ahriman had shrugged as though it had been a trivial encounter, something not worthy of remembrance. "It was a private affair," said Ahriman. Lemuel almost laughed before seeing that Ahriman was deadly serious. "Why would you want to know of it, anyway?"
"Seriously?"
"Yes."
"Maybe because the Emperor himself was there," said Lemuel, struggling to understand why Ahriman would think it strange he would want to know of such a singular event. "Or perhaps because the Emperor has returned to Terra and the Great Crusade has a new commander. Horus Lupercal is the War Master. Such an event is a turning point in the affairs of mankind. Surely you must see that."
"I do," nodded Ahriman, "though I fear I would make a poor teller of the tale. I am sure others will recount it better than I in times to come."
Ahriman sat behind his desk, sipping crisp, corn-coloured wine from an oversized pewter goblet. Lemuel sensed there was more to his reluctance to speak of Ulanor than any doubt as to his ability to give a good enough rendition. There would be little in the way of remembrance. Something was preying on Ahriman's mind, something that had happened upon the surface of Ulanor, but whatever it was, Lemuel would not hear it today. To see an Astartes troubled by concerns beyond the battlefield was surprising, and he regarded Ahriman with new eyes. Even stripped out of his armour and clad in a crimson tunic and khaki combat fatigues, Ahriman was enormous. Encased in his battle plate, his limbs were smooth and clean, machine-like, but now Lemuel could see the bulging musculature of his biceps and the undulant ridges of his pectorals. If anything, an Astartes without his armour was more frightening. His proportions were human, but also alien and gigantic. Lemuel had come to know Ahriman well since leaving Ulanor, not well enough to yet count them as friends, but well enough to read his moods. Of his remembrance of friends, he had seen little, for Camille and Callista spent the bulk of their time in the company of Anku Annan in the Foteps library, learning to develop their nascent abilities. As little as he had seen of his female friends, Lemuel had seen nothing at all of Mahavastu Callimachus. "Lemuel," said Ahriman, snapping his thoughts back to the presence.
"I'm sorry," said Lemuel. I was thinking about a friend and hoping he was well."
"Who?"
"Mahavastu Callimachus, scribe to the Primarch."
"Why would he not be doing well?"
Lemuel shrugged, unsure how much he should say.
"He seemed out of sorts the last time I saw him," he said. "But then he's a very old man, prone to the aches and pains of age, you understand."
"Not really," admitted Ahriman. "I am as fit now as I was 2 centuries ago."
Lemuel chuckled and said,
"That should amaze me, but it's astonishing how quickly you become accustomed to the extraordinary, especially with the Thousand Suns."
He lifted a modest cut crystal glass to his lips and drank, enjoying the rarity of a wine that didn't taste like it had been strained through a starship's urinary filtration system. "How are you liking the wine?" asked Ahriman.
"It is a more refined taste than I am used to," said Lemuel. "Flavoursome and forceful, yet with enough subtlety to surprise."
"The grapes were grown in underground vineyards on Prospero," explained Ahriman. "It is a vintage of my own concoction, based on a gene sample I took in Heritonga Bay on what was once the island of Demonsland."
"I never took the Astartes for students of viniculture."
"No, why not?" Lemuel cocked his head to one side, wondering if Ahriman was joking. Certainly the chief librarian of the Thousand Suns was a man of serious mien, but all too often he would puncture that with deadpan humour. From the hue of his aura, it seemed his question was honestly asked, and Lemuel floundered for an answer.
"Well, it's just that you are bred for war. I didn't think that left much room for less martial pursuits."
"In other words, you think we are only good for battle, is that it? The Astartes are simply weapons, killing tools, who cannot have interests beyond war." Lemuel saw a glint in Ahriman's eye and played along.
"You are very good at killing," he said. "Phoenix Crag taught me that."
"You are right. We are very good at killing. I think that is why my legion encourages its warriors to develop skills beyond the battlefield. After all, this crusade cannot last forever, and we will need to have a purpose beyond that when it is over. What will become of the warriors when there are no more wars?"
"They'll settle down and grow fine wine," said Lemuel, finishing his glass and accepting another as Ahriman leaned over to pour.
A shiver passed along his spine at the sheer absurdity of this moment. He chuckled and shook his head. "What is funny?" asked Ahriman.
"Oh, nothing really," he said. I was just wondering how Lemuel Gauman, a sometime academic, sometime dilettante of the esoteric, came to share a glass of wine with a genetically engineered post-human. 2 years ago, if someone had told me I'd be sitting here with you like this, I'd have thought they were mad."
"The feeling is mutual," Ahriman assured him.
"Then let us drink to new experiences," said Lemuel, raising his glass.
They did, and they enjoyed the strangeness of the moment. When he judged sufficient time had passed, Lemuel said,
"You never answered my question."
"Which question?"
"When you were training me with the Triumphi cards," said Lemuel. "When I asked what kind of diviner you were, one with an innate connection to the ether, or one who has to struggle for every morsel of truth. I get the feeling it's the former."
"Once I was, yes," said Ahriman, and Lemuel read pride in his aura, but also regret. "I could pluck the future from the ether without effort, guiding my fellowship along the most productive paths in war and study. But now I have to work hard for even a momentary glimpse into the patterns of the future."
"What changed?"
Ahriman stood and circled the table, picking up the deck of cards and shuffling them expertly. He could have been a croupier or a card sharp, thought Lemuel. The ease and dexterity with which Araman flicked the cards around his fingers was incredible, and he didn't seem to notice he was doing it. The tides of the great ocean are ever-changing, and its influence rises and falls. What was once a raging torrent can dwindle to a trickling brook in a fraction of a second. What was a gentle wave can rise to an all-consuming typhoon. Each practitioner's powers rise and fall with its moods, for it is a fickle mistress whose interest flits like a firefly in the dark.
"You speak of it as though it were a living thing," said Lemuel, seeing the wistful, faraway look in Adaman's eyes.
Adaman smiled and replaced the cards on the desk.
"Perhaps I do," he said. "The ancient sailors of Terra often claimed they had two wives, their earthly mates and the ocean. Each was jealous of the other, and it was said that one or the other would claim a seafarer's life. To live so close to the ether is to live with feet in two worlds. Both are dangerous, but a man can learn to read how they shift and dance in and out of sync with one another. The trick is to read those moments and crest the wave of power while it lasts."
Lemuel leaned forward and tapped a finger on the gold back cards.
"I don't think that's a trick I've mastered," he said.
"No, divination is not your forte," agreed Adaman, "though you show some skill with etheric reading. Perhaps I will schedule some time with Uthizar of the Athenians for you. He can develop this area of your psyche."
"I keep hearing of these cults, but why such specialization?" asked Lemuel. "The Sangomas I learned from were men and women who served the people of their townships in many different ways. They didn't confine themselves to one area of expertise. Why does your legion break up its teachings into different cults?"
"The Sangoma you speak of skimmed the tiniest fraction of learning from the great ocean, Lemuel. The lowliest probationer of any Thousand Suns cult understands and practices more of the mysteries than even the most gifted Sangoma."
"I don't doubt that," said Lemuel, taking another sip of wine. "But still, why so many?"
Araman smiled and said, "Finish your drink, and I will tell you of Magnus's first journey into the desolation of Prospero."
"Prospero is a paradise," began Araman, "a wondrous planet of light and beauty. Its mountains are soaring fangs of brilliant white, its forests verdant beyond imagining, and its oceans teem with life. It is a world returned to glory, but it was not always so. Long before the coming of Magnus, Prospero was all but abandoned."
Araman lifted a box of cold iron from the top shelf of his bookcase and placed it on the desk before Lemuel. He opened the lid to reveal a grotesque skull of alien origin, its surface dark and glossy as though coated in lacquer, elongated with extended mandibles and two enormous eye sockets behind them. It was insectoid and utterly repellent.
"What's that?" asked Lemuel, curling his lip in revulsion.
"This is a preserved exoskull of a Psychnuin, an alien predator native to Prospero."
"And why are you showing it to me?"
"Because without these creatures, the cults of the Thousand Suns would not exist."
"I don't understand."
"I'll show you," said Adaman, lifting the skull from the box. He held it out to Lemuel and said, "Don't worry. It is long dead, and its residual aura has long since dissipated into the great ocean."
"Still, no thanks. Those mandibles look like they could tear a man's head off."
"They could, but that was not what made the Psychnuin so dangerous. It was its reproductive cycle that was its most potent weapon. The female Psychnuin is drawn to psychic emanations and has a rudimentary fusion of telepathic and telekinetic powers. When fertile, the female psychically projects a clutch of its eggs into the brain of a host being with an unprotected mind, vulnerable to the power of the ether."
"That's disgusting," said Lemuel, genuinely horrified.
"That is not the worst of it."
"It's not?"
"Not by a long way," said Araman, with amused relish. "The eggs are small, no larger than a grain of sand, but by morning the following day they will hatch and begin to feed on the host's brain. At first the victim feels nothing more than a mild headache, but by afternoon he will be in agony, raving and insane, as his brain is devoured from the inside out. By nightfall he will be dead, his skull a writhing mass of plump maggots.
In the space of a few hours, the grubs have picked the carcass clean and will seek a dark place to hide in which to pupate. But the following day, they will emerge as adults, ready to hunt and reproduce.
Lemuel felt his guts roil, trying not to imagine the agony of being eaten alive by a host of parasites in his brain.
"What a horrible way to die," he said. "But I still don't understand how such vile creatures shape Prospero and the Thousand Suns."
"Patience, Lemuel," cautioned Adaman, sitting on the edge of the desk. "I am getting to that. You know of Tiska, the City of Light, yes?"
"It is a place I am greatly looking forward to seeing," said Lemuel.
"You will see it soon enough," smiled Adaman. "Tiska is the last outpost of a civilization wiped out thousands of years ago, a city where the survivors of a planet-wide cataclysm found refuge from the Psychnuin. We suspect some freak upsurge in the great ocean triggered an explosion of uncontrolled psychic potential within the population, driving the Psychnuin into a reproductive feeding frenzy. The civilization of Prospero collapsed, and the survivors fled to a city in the mountains."
"Tiska," said Lemuel, thrilled to be learning the lost history of Prospero.
"Yes," confirmed Adaman. "For thousands of years, the people of Tiska endured, while all they had built in the millennia since leaving Terra fell to dust. The surface of Prospero is dotted with the remains of their dead culture. The empty cities are now overgrown with forests and vines, the palaces of their kings overrun with wild beasts."
"How did they survive?"
"They salvaged enough knowledge and equipment from the destruction to construct techno-psychic arrays and sustainable energy sources, which then allowed them to build giant hydroponic gardens deep in the caverns of the ventral mountain ranges."
"Where you grow the fruit for delightful wines," said Lemuel, raising his glass in a toast. "But that's not what I meant. How did they survive the Psychnuin?"
Adaman tapped his head and said, "By developing the very powers that made them so vulnerable. The Psychnuin were drawn to Tiska in their thousands, but the survivors were able to train their most gifted psychers to use their minds to erect invisible barriers of pure thought. They were primitive, bombastic powers compared to the subtle arts we employ today, but they kept the creatures at bay. And so the practitioners of the mysteries remain locked in their limited understanding of the great ocean's power until the coming of Magnus."
Lemuel leaned in and placed his wine glass on the edge of the desk. The origin myths of the Primarchs were often shrouded in allegory and hyperbole, embroidered over time with all manner of fanciful details involving tests of strength, contests of arms, or similarly outlandish feats. To hear of a Primarch's deeds on his home world from a warrior of his legion would surely be the greatest achievement of any remembrancer. An authentic account, as opposed to one embellished by people like the iterators. Lemuel's pulse rate rose in expectation, and he felt a chill gust at his shoulder, like the breath of an invisible passerby. He frowned as he saw a shimmer of red in the cut crystal of his wineglass, the hint of a golden eye looking back at him from the liquid. Lemuel glanced over his shoulder, but there was no one there. Looking back at his glass, it was simply wine. He shook off the unease the image had conjured. Adaman was looking at him with an amused expression on his face, as though expecting him to say something.
"You were saying," said Lemuel, when Adaman didn't continue, "about Magnus."
"I was," said Adaman, "but it is not my story to tell." Confused, Lemuel sat back in his seat and asked,
"Then whose story is it to tell?"
"Mine," said Magnus, appearing at Lemuel's shoulder as if from thin air. "I shall tell it."